Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Daruk. The clock is ticking for states to ensure that they can safely and effectively administer this fall's election. In March, it became clear that states needed to reconfigure in-person voting and significantly scale up mail voting so that Americans could vote during the pandemic. Since then, we've seen postponed elections, consolidated voting places, long lines, mail ballots that never reached voters, and long delays in counting those ballots. And that's all been during the primaries, a much smaller affair than what we'll see this fall. Now, only 100 days remain until Election Day. So, are states ready? And are they actively working to solve the problems that we've seen? Here with me to discuss are elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hey, Nathaniel.
Hey, Galen.
And also with us is Mirna Perez, Director of Voting Rights and Elections at the Brennan Center for Justice. Hello, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you, Mirna. At this point, how close are the states to being ready to administer the election in November, by your estimation?
I think we're in store for a big mess unless people start acting really, really quickly. States are in different stages of readiness. Most of them are not very close to being able to pull off a smooth and safe election. And it is only going to get exacerbated the longer it takes for them to get the resources that they need in order to be able to make the changes that they're going to need to be able to make. Right now, Congress is considering proposals to give them $3.6 billion. And Congress needs to act quickly because the clock is ticking and there are a lot of steps that go into an election. And this election is going to be unprecedented in a whole bunch of different ways.
And why do they need $4 billion? I mean, I think people don't generally think of voting being an expensive thing.
I'm happy to answer that because there are a lot of changes they need to make. If they're going to get an increase in vote by mail, they need people or machines to process them. If they're going to be mailing more vote by mail applications out, they need machines that fold them and send them out. They need scanners that when they come in to be able to say if they came in on time. They need people to be able to observe the ways that they got signed and then other people to be able to make sure that the observers didn't get anything wrong or were discriminatory. They need to pay their poll workers more so that we can recruit more of them. They need to buy extra cleaning supplies so that they can sanitize all of our polling locations. We've done an assessment about what it would take, a good estimate of what our states and localities need in order to be ready. And it's about $3.6 billion.
In doing a little bit of research, I was actually, you know, maybe this naive on my part, surprised at how expensive elections are. A lot of localities spent a lot of the resources that they were given through the first part of the CARES Act on administering their primaries, and it was a lot of money. I mean, so can you help us put this in perspective here? Like, how much does administering a national election cost normally?
We actually don't have good statistics for that because we chronically underfund our elections. Like, compared to the way that other democracies run, We don't. We expect election administrators to pull off elections with, you know, bubble gum and duct tape. And our voting machines are not up to date. Our online registration systems are not hardened against attack. We don't have enough testers that look at our election materials to make sure that people understand them. I mean, one of the things that I remember is that a particular jurisdiction who will now remain unnamed sent out materials about their primary and the date was wrong and they weren't trying to disenfranchise somebody. They didn't have somebody who had the bandwidth to be a proofreader to make sure that the template that they used from the last time didn't just roll right through and they didn't change the date. Those are all things that we can fix if we give people more resources to run our elections, and we are, under the best of circumstances, underfunded. And when we're talking about the changes and adaptations that we need to make right now, we're not even close. You know, if we want to be the best democracy in the world, we need to be willing to invest in it. We need to be willing to pay for it. We can't get democracy on the cheap. I think that's an important lesson for us all because right now the crisis hitting us is the coronavirus. But in other years, it could be weather. And in other years, it could be foreign cyber criminals trying to cripple our infrastructure. Our elections are so important. They need to be resilient against whatever crisis the moment throws at us. And that requires resources and planning.
Nathaniel, I know you have been tracking state by state as each of these states has been changing its rules. in order to help people vote this fall. So where do we stand? Give us a roundup of what kind of changes have been made so far and maybe what states haven't actually changed their rules at this point.
Generally speaking, there are three different categories for vote by mail access or absentee voting access. There are the states that require an excuse to vote absentee. There are the states that allow anyone to vote absentee without an excuse. And then there are the states that actually conduct mail elections by default, i.e. they mail ballots to every voter. And so states, for example, like Colorado, Oregon, Washington do that, even under normal scenarios. Many states have liberalized their election laws, either through executive order or legislatively, or even sometimes through the courts, to make it easier for people to vote by mail this year. The latest standings that I have are that currently there are 7 states plus the District of Columbia that are conducting default mail elections. An additional 34 states are allowing people to vote by mail for any reason. You know, technically some states are saying, oh, we're requiring an excuse to vote absentee this year, but being afraid of catching coronavirus counts as an excuse. So that, of course, that basically covers everybody. So in total, 41 states have made it either very easy, you know, by default, or easy to the point of some, at least voters can do it for any reason by mail. That leaves 9 states at the current count that are currently still requiring an excuse. That said, a good chunk of these will probably change their laws between now and November. There is still time, although as Myrna says, time is running out to implement these changes. But for example, I believe as we speak, New York is passing through a law that would lift the excuse requirement. In addition, West Virginia during the primary, they lifted their excuse requirement. And as long as the COVID-19 state of emergency is in place, that excuse requirement will continue to be lifted. So assuming that stays in place through November, West Virginia would also join the ranks of the 41.
So at this point, are there any states that we don't think are going to allow voters to submit a mail ballot if they wish to?
Absolutely. I'm less optimistic than my friend Nathaniel here. I think the upshot for voters is that at this moment in time, right now, on July 23rd, 2020, we have about 10 states that are not going to let every voter who wants to vote by mail in November do so. And there's going to be a battle royale in some of these states. For example, in Texas, this went to the courts, and the courts thus far have sided with the state of Texas. So I think we need to be prepared for the fact that some Americans are not going to have access to a mail ballot. And who is eligible is not the only important criteria for meaningful access. The other question is are they going to understand the rules enough to know that they need to apply in advance for it? Are they going to know what the deadlines are? Are they going to have the postage stamp to return it? Are they going to be able to return it in time and rely on the post office to deliver it before the certification deadlines? And then does the state have the kind of counting rules that give voters the benefit of the doubt, or they shut voters out? The way I like to think about it is that there's 4 components to vote by mail. The first is who's eligible, and we've spent a bunch of time talking about that. The second is how easy do they make it for you to access a ballot? The third is do they make it easy for you to return? And then the fourth is that when you return it, do they allow you to count? And states are all over the map on some of these things. Some states get a lot of notoriety. For example, Georgia had a really big problem with the way that they were doing their signature verification in the vote by mail system, where people thought it was discriminatory because they were kicking out so many of the vote by mail ballots that had come in. So there are a lot of different strands to vote by mail. And to that leads me as a lawyer who's been doing this work for a really long time, that works with all different kinds of communities, to the conclusion that we cannot just rely on vote by mail. We have to protect our polling places, because there are so many ways in which the vote by mail system might not work for somebody that we need to make sure that people have safe and sanitary in-person voting options.
Yeah, I definitely don't think we should assume that the states will make the change. You know, I think it'll ultimately be some of them will. But yeah, you know, so in the primaries, I think it was just Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi that didn't do it. And so therefore, I don't expect them to make it the change for the general as well. Also, some states that made it for the primary may not make it for the general. So I don't know, if I had to guess, I would say maybe 45 states will ultimately, somewhere in that neighborhood, will ultimately allow vote by mail for any reason. But yeah, that's just a guess. And I take Myrna's point 100%.
You know, the problems that we saw during the primary were not just problems relating to whether or not people could vote by mail. Of course, there were problems in person as well that didn't just come down to politicians bickering at the state level. It came down to also decisions that were made by elections administrators at the local level and so on. So at this point in time, you know, some of the hurdles that still stand over the next 100 days, are they problems that politicians need to fix, or are they problems that elections administrators need to figure out how to deal with?
I think that there are problems that both of them need to deal with, and they have different lanes. The politicians need to make sure that the election administrators have the resources that they need. We need to make sure that we get a congressional disbursement of about $4 billion to the states, and the state politicians need to have the gumption to fill in the gaps. Now, of course, very few state legislatures are in session right now, and state budgets are in terrible positions. So one of the additional ways that politicians can be helpful is to provide support and assistance to the election administrators who are desperately claiming that they need it. So for example, we're constantly being told by election administrators that they need more places to serve as polling sites. And they need more poll workers, especially now. Right now, a lot of schools are closed, a lot of office buildings are closed, a lot of private companies don't want to serve as polling locations. Can you imagine the kind of good synergies that would happen if local politicians were going to use all of their political influence to be able to describe to folks that own buildings, whether they be churches, community groups, businesses, and said, hey, why don't you up your spot to be a polling site? And what if they took all of their supporters and said, hey, do your civic duty by going and serving as a poll worker. We need them now. So some of the work is active and some of it is supportive that politicians can do. Election administrators have similar opportunities and similar limits. State law is what state law is, and they're not going to be in a position to contradict state law, but there are a number of instances in which they have some discretion and they have the ability to make state law be a floor, not a ceiling. And if they've got the political will and they've got the political support, they can be very pro-voter in that.
Yeah, I think just to zoom out for people, I think, you know, what we saw in the primaries was this like fundamental notion of, as you alluded to, Galen, polling places were consolidated in many places. So in kind of infamously Wisconsin, Milwaukee went from more than 200 polling places in normal circumstances to just 5. And this was due, yeah, to, as Myrna mentioned, places withdrawing from being polling places because they were afraid of getting a bunch of new people, and also poll workers who tend to be elderly and therefore susceptible to COVID-19, poll workers withdrawing from their poll duties. And I will say that some of the states that have had more success in their primaries have been those that had time to replace the poll workers and really put in a big recruiting campaign for more poll workers. So I will say, if listeners are looking for something to do to help out, something you can do if you are able to health-wise is to volunteer to be a poll worker at your polling place.
When we look at these challenges overall, does it seem like during the primary or during the general, they have the likelihood to affect certain groups in the country disparately?
We have to remember that we're in very, very difficult and disrupted times right now, and people have different margins for being able to devote to barriers and overcoming those barriers. And the kinds of hurdles that I might face, I have a job that supports my right to vote and really wants to make sure that I'm able to vote. So I could say that I can take some time off and go through a bunch of hoops to try and get to make sure that I have a ballot that counts. Other people are not so lucky. And so when we see barriers, they're going to hit the hardest for people that have the fewest amount of margins. They're also going to hit the hardest, the folks who are low information, either because they're not plugged into all the channels. I remember I was talking to an election administrator and I was asking them, what sort of public education do you do? And they're like, oh, we announced it on our Twitter feed. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, who are the people that are signed up for the Twitter feed of their local election office? Those are not going to be the people that are going to have a hard time overcoming the barriers that happen when somebody changes a polling location. So I think it's pretty safe to say that when something goes wrong in an election, it's going to hit minority communities, poor communities, elderly communities the hardest, in part because the margins of being able to overcome these barriers are going to look different, and in part because of the information that is being directed at them and the level of engagement that past actors have tried to bring them into the buddy politic.
Yeah, Galen, I actually have a poll on this. So according to the ABC News Washington Post poll that came out last weekend, there was a pretty stark class divide in terms of who said that they would prefer to vote by mail this year and who said they would prefer to continue voting in person. So respondents with postgraduate degrees said they preferred voting by mail 54% to 44%. Those with just a college degree were split down the middle, 49 to 49. Respondents who attended but didn't graduate from college said they preferred in-person voting 59% to 37%. And respondents with a high school degree or less preferred to vote in person 69% to 29%. So I think that it's clear that assuming that things don't change between now and November, things like closed or consolidated polling places are going to disproportionately impact voters with less education. You saw the same splits in the poll among income groups, where high-income voters said that they were likelier to vote by mail, and low-income groups said that they preferred to vote in person. So those concerns are definitely there.
I want to talk a little bit more about the challenges in voting by mail versus voting in person during this pandemic.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze. Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Shopify.com/538.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Nathaniel, you mentioned that there is a divide, a class divide, in who plans to vote by mail versus voting in person. And Mirna, you also mentioned earlier in the conversation that voting by mail can't be the only option. When you look at all of the challenges that vote by mail brings into the equation, right? Local elections officials have to make sure they have enough paper ballots to send out. You have to rely on the USPS to make sure that the ballots get there on time. You have to, once again, rely on the USPS to make sure the ballots get back to the place that they belong. You have to make sure that signatures are accepted. And we know that this disproportionately affects young people, people of color, for example. Then you have to count all of those ballots in an efficient and timely fashion, understanding that delays can undermine faith in the outcome of the election. You know, there are some states, as we mentioned, like Colorado, that do universal vote by mail, and they do it well, and they do it effectively, and people have faith in the system. But given that most states don't have that kind of system in place. Why are we putting so much emphasis on vote by mail as opposed to just trying to make sure that people can vote safely in person as other countries have done during this pandemic?
We need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Life is hard right now. People are massively disrupted. People have different risk tolerances. People have different risk factors. Voters in a time of crisis need more options, not fewer. And I think it is a mistake to say that we should either focus on vote by mail or we should focus on in person. The honest answer, if we believe in a robust and participatory and inclusive democracy, is that we need to do both. Because there are some people for whom vote by mail is not going to work for, and there are some people who cannot vote in person. And even those who could vote in person, we actually want them voting by mail. That way there are fewer people showing up at the polls so that we can better protect those who can't realistically vote by mail. We need to be committed to a democracy that includes all of us. And that means looking with a very clear-eyed about who votes and how they vote and what they need in order to be able to do so safely. And that means both vote by mail and in-person polling places.
Yeah, to that point, you know, I think that it's important that people understand that decisions about expanding vote by mail are almost independent of decisions about what you're going to do with in-person polling places. You know, before this whole pandemic started, we just had one concept of what voting by mail was. This was what happens in Oregon and Washington and stuff like that, which is you mail every voter a ballot, and instead of traditional polling places, you open a few kind of vote centers, kind of one-stop shops for all your voting needs, a few of those per county. But in the primary so far, you've seen states decide to mail ballots to every voter. You've seen states decide to mail applications for absentee ballots to every voter. And then at the same time, you've seen states do everything from open polling places as normal to closing all polling places. And I think a good example of this is Idaho, which sent absentee ballot applications to every voter, which I think is something that a lot of liberals and vote by mail advocates would cheer. But at the same time, they closed in-person voting places completely, which is something that a lot of voting rights advocates think is bad, as Mirna just said. So, you know, expanding vote by mail access doesn't necessarily mean that you are expanding access to voting in general.
And Galen, if I could push back on one of your frames, you raised some of the concerns with vote by mail as administrative trouble, and you're 100% right. But I also want to point out that there's a social and a racial component to vote by mail challenges. If you live on a Native American reservation, there's a pretty good chance that the way your tribe understands your address is different than the way the U.S. Post Office understands your address. People that live in highly dense areas or really rural areas do not have the same kind of mail reliability that people that live in suburbs do. And we can't be baking inequalities into the way that we vote. That's not going to get us good results. I'd also point out that there are people that have physical or visual impairments that can't autonomously and independently use a mail ballot. And then there is a language component where in many parts of the country, by law, you are entitled to language assistance if you need it when you are voting. And that's not something you can get via mail. And then there's an important cultural component. There are Americans that remember when voting meant you were going to lose your job, or you might get attacked by fire hoses and dogs. And if you have that kind of cultural connection to the act of in-person voting, you're not going to be that afraid of a virus, right? Like, this is just another barrier that somebody is putting in front of you. And we need to take account for the fact that our country is very diverse and people have different lived experiences and people have different needs. So while, yes, we need in-person options because somebody's going to screw something up, there are a lot of reasons that have very little to do with vote by mail processes, whether or not they're able to process applications on time, whether or not someone understands the rule, that are going to make it such that some communities are going to prefer to vote in person. And we need to be mindful of that when we're designing our policies.
Is it your best advice that all polling locations that are open during a normal election remain open this fall?
I can't have a blanket statement by that. And the reason I can't is because we are asking people to look at the way that the polling places are configured. We're about to issue guidance on how polling places should be secure. And there are some places that are not set up in a way to be able to comport with social distancing. So rather than saying something as generic as everyone that was open needs to be open before, we're saying voters need to be given the same level of access as they had before. And if it means instead of this church, look at this other church that's really close by, we'll do it that way.
One thing that I've been looking at each primary and like its access to mail and in-person voting, and it's hard to find. We're a data site, obviously. It's hard to find data on the number of polling places open in a lot of places. You hear anecdotes a lot of the time about, you know, oh, this polling place has been closed, but it's hard to know, like, oh, did, you know, X state close, you know, just a few polling places, or is this happening in every single county across the state, and therefore it's like a 40% reduction across the board. Obviously, there's a big difference between that and like small relocations probably makes sense, whereas, you know, things like what Milwaukee did were clearly detrimental.
Do you think that in part because of the national political conversation around mail voting, largely that President Trump has eschewed it as a way for people to commit fraud, do you think that undue focus has been put on mail voting and perhaps not enough attention has been placed on in-person voting?
I think not enough attention has been put on in-person voting. I think one of the things that has been happening largely is that white progressives are super excited about vote by mail, and it took a really long time for them to realize that not everybody gets the mail service that they get. And people like me had to do a lot of education to white progressives about why a model in like Colorado and Oregon and Washington isn't going to work as well for communities that are more diverse. And now I think people are getting it, but I will tell you that was the single most common conversation I had to have the first month of the pandemic, educating people why it was a mistake to only move vote by mail. I also think that we are in a problem where some advocates were trying to answer the vote by mail question forever. And what I say by that is saying, instead of saying, what are we going to do as a country in November? And does vote by mail work now? They were instead trying to say, everybody should have universal access to vote by mail forever, which is a different political fight. And I think that that kind of long game political fight by some of the proponents of vote by mail made it harder for us to bring in person into the conversation. But I think it's shifted now. I think it's changed now, and people are starting to understand the impact of it, especially in states that cut down in person and leaned heavily on vote by mail. They're realizing, for exactly the reasons that you mentioned earlier, in person needs to be a fail safe to people that wanted to vote by mail. And on top of that, in person has a constituency that's very natural.
Okay, so we have laid out here challenges in both voting by mail and voting in person. Nathaniel, you're tracking litigation and legislation for 538 over the coming months. What do you see as the main sticking points that have yet to be resolved between now and November 3rd?
I mean, yeah, there's so much. I think clearly, you know, one of the big things will be access to mail voting, which it tends to be a, you know, high-level policymaker thing. You know, another big thing will be access to in-person voting, which tends to be more locally driven. I don't want to give out specific prescriptions, but I think that one clearly best practice is talking to states like Colorado, like Oregon, that have been doing these predominantly mail elections for a long time, and seeing what stumbling blocks they ran into when they first started doing it. What are some of the things that you don't think about the first time, you know, when you or I thinks about mail elections that they might need to implement? I think some good examples of that are, Myrna mentioned, the ability to request an absentee ballot online, which a surprising number of states do not have. In addition, this notion of curing ballots. So after a ballot comes in, you know, despite what President Trump says, voting by mail is secure, and, you know, in large part because there are these verification processes, including you sign the envelope that the ballot is in, and then that's matched against the signature that you have on file. And in states that have a lot of mail voting, they tend to have processes in place to, if there's a mismatch in the signature, to go check with the voter to ensure that, you know, they meant to cast that ballot, et cetera. They have the ability to track ballots. So sometimes you can literally see, make sure that the ballot you sent to, you know, Nathaniel Rakich is the ballot that Nathaniel Rakich sent back and signed. But a lot of states maybe that are just, you know, maybe they sent out a bunch of absentee ballot applications and they thought that that would be sufficient. You know, now they have a bunch of mail ballots, but they don't have a way to cure those ballots. And so in some of these primaries, I know Nevada, you know, some New Jersey and some local elections, you had a very high rate of rejection of absentee ballots because of probably very like simply explained signature discrepancies. You know, people either forgot a signature because they weren't used to voting by mail or their arm was in a sling, something really kind of elementary like that. And their signature just looked a little bit different. In addition, there's just a lot of subjective judgments in, you know, always, does this signature look the same or not? And some places have started to adapt to that with more kind of automated processes for that. So these little things that people don't think about would go a long way toward making sure that as few people are disenfranchised because of the coronavirus as possible.
What keeps you up at night, Myrna, at this point in the process? Like, are you expecting things to go wrong on November 3rd? Is that just your expectation at this point?
Things always go wrong in elections. I think the question is what is the scale and what is the scope? My fear is that certain politicians at all sorts of levels of government are already trying to pre-tarnish the outcome. They're already trying to preview that whatever outcome it is, it's going to be rigged or it's going to be riddled with fraud. And so that we are not going to have an outcome that enough Americans feel like they can trust. And I think that that is incredibly disappointing and frustrating and irresponsible, because we are at a moment in American history where Americans are looking at our institutions and examining, are we responsive enough? Are we reflective enough of all of us? And this is not a time where I think the country is well served by having an election that folks don't feel good about. Elections are the way we resolve our political differences. They're how we set the direction of the country. And other countries are not able to resolve their political differences peacefully. And we have a mechanism for doing so. So we need to make sure that this election is as smooth and safe and accurate as we all can. And I don't see enough commitment from everyone in the country to this. And I hope that changes really soon, because we, again, are at a moment right now where we need to have an election that we feel good about.
Yeah, we've spent most of the podcast talking about the run-up to Election Day. And yeah, I agree with Myrna that the aftermath of Election Day will be just as important. You know, we track election results here at 538, and certainly, you know, kind of getting our 11 p.m. Precincts reporting fix on election night is not as important as ensuring that everybody has the ability to vote if they want to and are eligible. But, that is something we need to be prepared for as well, that, you know, normally we know who won the election on election night. We get most of the votes on election night, and that's not going to be the case this year because mail ballots take a long time to count. Many states are allowing people to postmark their ballots by Election Day, which means that they can be received after Election Day. So basically, by definition, the counts on the night of November 3rd are going to be incomplete. And, you know, yeah, that's going to require patience. I think that there is, you know, I think there are extreme examples, like New York is still counting ballots from its June 23rd primary. And I think that that is unacceptable because those candidates need to start their general election campaign. campaigns. And of course, eventually for the general election, they'll need to be signed sworn into office. But I do think that Americans and journalists in particular, I think, who, again, are spoiled for getting election results early, need to be patient about understanding that, you know, the results are not going to be final for weeks and at least to allow, you know, multiple days for a winner to be declared if necessary. And of course, you know, the possibility exists that, especially if, because President Trump has been talking down mail ballots so much, the possibility exists that Republicans will tend to vote in person and Democrats will tend to vote by mail, which could lead to the early results on Election Day, the in-person votes, skewing Republicans. So maybe President Trump sees that he's leading in Florida and Pennsylvania and Arizona and declares victory, but then the ballots are all counted days later, and lo and behold, Joe Biden has won those states. And that's a scenario that, yeah, it's scary because can you imagine President Trump admitting that he was wrong and saying that he lost after all? I think it's a question mark, unfortunately.
Those are all really good points. I wanted to wrap up the podcast here, but you just mentioned that New York is a month on and still hasn't announced its results. What is going on? What happened?
They're coming in very slowly. You know, it's not that they haven't announced any results, but a number of races are still unresolved. I think it's a combination of, you know, first of all, New York allows absentee ballots to be received up to a week after Election Day. So they were always going to be a late counting state in the event of a predominantly male election. They're also a state that usually does not vote very much by mail at all. And suddenly they're ramping up very quickly. So this is probably, you know, they're probably being overwhelmed. Mirna, you're based in New York, right? So you might know more than I do on this.
No, I mean, I think you spoke really eloquently and accurately, and I hope it landed well with the audience, Nathaniel. If we want to make sure that people can vote up until the very last minute by vote by mail, i.e. on Election Day, we're not going to get enough results on election night. If we want people to have the opportunity to correct something that might have kicked their ballot from being counted, like they forgot to sign it, we need to build in time for that, which means we're not going to know the results on Election Day. If we want there to be transparency and audits, those also take time. We're not going to find the results on Election Day. And I think Americans need to grapple with the fact that we want a bunch of different things. We want immediate results, but we also want transparency and voters to be given every opportunity to cure their ballots and voters to be given more time. And those things cannot peaceably coexist. So yes, New York is an example of a bunch of factors. We can't exclude human error and poor planning in that too. But for entirely good and pro-voter reasons, we can't expect results on election night in many states. And then when you couple on that human frailties and fewer resources, we definitely can't expect results on Election Day. And I think that that's going to be a big attitude adjustment for Americans and for journalists. And I'm really glad that Nathaniel, you raised that.
What are we calling it here at 538? Are we calling it election week or election month, Nathaniel?
I think election month is going to end up being more accurate. You know, even under normal circumstances in 2018 and 2016, all the votes in California weren't counted until like Thanksgiving. So I think you're going to see that happening in most states this year.
All right, well, we'll have more to talk about on this topic as we get down to Election Day, and of course, plenty after the fact as we cover, as you said, Election Month. But that's it for now, so thank you, Mirna.
Thank you, guys. This was super fun. I hope you guys invite me back.
Absolutely, and thank you, Nathaniel.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.